My name is Austin, and I am an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Dustina and Kobe, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or your understanding. John will read the preamble.
My name is Jim. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees to AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Thank you. Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. John will read the steps.
My name is John. I'm an alcoholic. 12 steps of AA. 1. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. 4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6. Were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7. Humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, excuse me, as we understood Him, praying only for our knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to all alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you. Mary will read the traditions.
I'm Mary. I'm an alcoholic. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Matt.
Hi, my name is Matt. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm sorry. I asked. I got permission. I didn't do it my way. So my name is Matt, and I am an alcoholic, and it is really a pleasure to be here tonight and a privilege. And you know, I just realized that, you know, I get up here and I get so nervous, right? And it's not like I'm nervous because there's so many people here. I'm nervous because AA is so important and has had such a profound, you know, effect on my life. And I want to, you know, like I searched for this for a long time. And I'm sure there's somebody out there who's also searching, who came in the back of the room with their head down like I did, and, you know, who needs to hear the message. And I want to, like, give it to everybody what I got. You know, that's why I get nervous. It's a pretty good reason to get nervous. So, you know, like I said, my name is Matt. I'm an alcoholic. My sponsor, his name is Duncan. I'm very glad that he took me through the steps because he was not concerned that I liked him. He was concerned that I got the solution. And that was important. That's important because, you know, I needed somebody to tell me, you know, you're full of baloney. And you've been around AA for 7 years, and you've always gotten what you've gotten, and you went back out because you don't follow direction and because you're unwilling to do the work. And that's why you're in the situation you're in now. And he said, I could tell you that because I was in that situation. So, you know, I'm very grateful for that. So I wound up in this room about, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago. I came to Atlantic Group. It was kind of like the last stop. I had been around AA for a while, dry, not working the steps, no, you know, sponsor. And I was miserable, which led me to therapy, which, you know, led me to trying some other solutions, which didn't work out for me. And, you know, by the time I got here, I was desperate. I was sitting in the back of the room on that side, and I was just looking around for people that I didn't want to see. So I would know where they were, and it wasn't that I didn't want to see them. I was afraid to see them because of something that I had done or, you know, some idiotic way I acted or something I thought that they were mad at me for, you know, me. And so I was scanning the room for those people. I didn't see any of them. I kind of got a little bit comfortable, and I heard the speakers. And I'm really grateful that I came here because all the speakers, they spoke about the solution, which I'm not saying that I never, you know, nobody ever said it in another meeting. I'm sure plenty of people did. I just never heard it like I heard it here. You know, I was pretty desperate when I got here. And, you know, I left the meeting and I came back and, you know, I'm not really sure, but like the things that happened were, you know, I was like seeing like groups of people that were smiling and like having a good time. And I'd been around the AA for a while. I'm like, how did they get that? You know what I mean? And at first you're like, oh, it's a clicky meeting. That's what I thought. You know, how am I ever going to get there? And, you know, now I have a group of friends, you know, because I came and because I took direction. But I just want to back up a little bit. I'm here because, you know, I can't drink safely. And what does that mean? It means that when I start drinking, I don't have the ability to choose when I'm going to stop or if I'm going to stop. Normally, I stopped because I passed out. You know, I became physically unable to get alcohol into my body. That's when I stopped drinking. So that's what we're doing here. And I don't want to go through like a whole, you know, there's a million stories that go along with that. It took me a long time to realize that that was my problem. You know, and it's an allergy to alcohol, as they cause it. And I've got it. Once I start drinking, I don't have the choice whether I'm going to stop. So that's what I'm doing here. And, you know, there's some things that come along with that. And, you know, the attitudes and the, you know, the self-centeredness that come along with alcoholism, I was riddled with it. Mostly fear. Fear was like a big one for me, you know. I spent the first, I don't know, 20, probably 18 years of my life like this because I was afraid to look at people. Thank you. You know, I don't do that anymore. You know what I mean? Like, I can look all of you in the eye. You know, that's not me. I did not do that. You guys did that. You know, God did that. I could not do that on my own. You know, I was, you know, I have this thing, like, really bad. Like, my own belief is that, you know, some people, they just, they have the allergy and they clean up and they don't drink and they work the steps and they're fine. I, like, have the allergy and, like, I got to be on it, you know, because I have, like, a maybe an extra strong strain of alcoholism or something like this. I don't know what it is. But, like, you know, a few days without praying and, like, going to meetings and talking to other alcoholics, and I'm, like, you know, in my office getting mad at everybody and, you know, snapping at my wife and, you know, doing all this things and blaming everybody. That's another big thing I did. I blamed everybody. That stopped at step four a couple of years ago. So I'm really glad to be here. And, you know, if you're new, and, it, you know, for me, the case was I wasn't new. You know what I mean? There was a long time there where I was not new, and I needed help, and I did not know how to ask for it. Because I thought that because I was sober, not drinking, because I was sober, I thought, how could I ask for help? You know, everything should be fine, you know? And I could not muster up the courage on my own to ask for help. I really was suffering big time under the lash of alcoholism without a solution. And I went back out again. Now, if you're here tonight and you're new, or you're not new and you're, you know, suffering in that way, it could stop tonight. You know what I mean? There's tons of people here that, you know, work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as it's outlined in the big book. This book right here. The first 164 pages, the directions on how to get sober. How am I doing on time? Okay, cool. You know, so grab somebody who's got a sponsor who's been through that book and just tell them you need help. Or, you know, you could even tell them, like, you know, you're doing good, but, you know, I kind of want to, like, you know, maybe up it a little bit. You don't have to tell them the whole thing. But the deal is, you know, I worked that steps, and all the problems, everything that I had been fighting throughout my alcoholism, the fear, the, you know, it was really fear. I was riddled with fear, fearful of people, fearful of mail, fearful of good things, fearful of bad things. I was fearful of everything. The fear is gone. I'm no longer afraid as a result of working those steps. And, you know, maybe you don't have to go out. Like, I had to go out and, you know, get pretty desperate. You know, what else did I want to say? My life is beyond my wildest dreams. You know, last night, I'll just close with this. Last night, I was talking to my wife, and I said, I'm going to write down a list of things that I've gotten, you know, because they say, you know, your life beyond your wildest dreams, that I've gotten that I never really wanted, that, like, you know, are the, you know, the greatest things in my life now. And I realized I didn't need to write down the list because I know what they are. You know what I mean? And I got them from taking direction from my sponsor. And I only became willing to do that because I was so desperate. I mean, I almost died. So I'm not, like, you know, some great willing guy. But one of the things that I got is I got the ability to take direction, you know, with and without debate. You know, I got the ability to listen to another person. You know, I got the ability, thank you. I got the ability to notice the timekeeper, because the first time I spoke here, I was like, I never saw the timekeeper. I was halfway through my story, and it was already 10 minutes. So it was pretty embarrassing. Anyway, so, you know, I got the ability to pray. I got the ability to feel peace. Peace. I spent 28 years on this earth without a moment's peace in my life. Maybe 29 years without a moment's peace. I did not know peace until I opened that book and started working those steps. I really didn't. Not like I've found, you know, through a relationship with a higher power. Probably one of the greatest things that I've gotten back is, it says in the 11th step prayer, by self-forgetting one finds. I find that to be like I'm stuck on that line. By self-forgetting one finds. I've got to go now. But what that means is if I'm not thinking about myself, I'm thinking about you guys. And if I'm thinking about you guys and I'm talking to you and I'm listening to what's going on with you, I'm finding new things, you know. And that is a gift which I never would have wished for, which happens to be one of the greatest things in my life today. Thank you.
Thank you. Our second 10-minute speaker is John L.
Good evening. My name is John L. and I'm an alcoholic. I'm just going to let you know that I'm freaking out. And, you know, I've been freaking out since last Tuesday. And I'm going to tell you, it was really bad because I was giving myself an anxiety attack on the train today. But then this 20-something-year-old guy gets on the train and homeless, begging for change. And, you know, it brought me back immediately to gratitude. And it's really not about me today. I'm so grateful. I've come so far. I'm so happy to be alive today, you know, and that's how deep it runs for me, you know. Okay, I said I'm John L. I'm an alcoholic. My sponsor's name is Donnie, and my home group is the Atlantic Group. My sobriety date is March 8th, 2006. You know, I was raised in an alcoholic household like many of us. A lot of abuse, a lot of pain, a lot of fear. You know, at age 3, my mother gave me this gift of putting me in violin class, and I found my first high, which was retreating into my music. No one can tell me what to do as long as I was playing. And it was really a gift and a curse in some ways. At age 10, I went on my first orchestra tour over to England. And I was really angry. I was through a tantrum in the airport. I didn't want to go. My mother wasn't going to go with me, and I wanted her to come. And as much as I threw a tantrum, she told me my life depended on me going on this tour at 10. So, you know, I'm on this plane and I'm freaking out and I'm crying and I'm telling myself I can't wait till I get my own house and I can do what I want to do. And I look over and I see these kids and they're having a great time. Like they're like 16 years old, they're having a great time. And so one kid goes, "Oh man, this tastes like cocoa." Another one's like, no, it tastes like coffee. They were drinking Bailey's Irish Cream. And you know, I convinced them to get me some. After two little bottles, I felt a little warm inside. By 4, I had arrived. And by six of them, I had kissed my first boy. So, you know, that was my life, you know. And I was very excited about this. So the whole time I was overseas, it's really what I enjoyed doing. I felt fine. I didn't miss home. I didn't miss the dog. I didn't miss anything. But I tell you what, though, if you would have told me that in 15 years, my life would have snowballed into alcohol would have taken away my family, my friends, my home, my jobs. If you would have told me that 15 years later from that day, I would have been homeless on the streets of Camden, I would have called you a liar. And that's what it did to me. You know, my last 2 years of my drinking, you know, I had burnt all my bridges. You know, people had tried to help me and put me on Broadway, playing in pit orchestras, went on numerous tours, you know, all these fancy places. And I tell you what, I don't remember any of it. I don't remember any of it. Alcohol took away all my memories. You know, the last 2 years of my drinking, I went about 6 or 7 programs, 8 months of incarceration. and on the rest of the time on the street. And, you know, it stopped working. The alcohol stopped working. And I found myself crying a lot on the street. You know, it was cold. I was lonely. And I remember wanting to call my mother and ask and tell her I wanted to come home. But I know what her answer would be. You got to get yourself help. And I wasn't willing. You know, so what happened was I was getting out of this car one day and I heard somebody call my name, Johnelle, Johnelle. And I'm looking around. I didn't know who it was. I thought I was bugging. And sorry. And it was a friend of mine that I had done a lot of drinking with, and he was sober. He had been in a program for about 6 months. And he looked at me, he basically said, I look like crap. Basically said he didn't recognize me. He took me home with him and told me that there was another way. He said I would be a wasted human being if I didn't get myself together. And, you know, for some reason, I've heard that many times from other people, but for someone you drank with to tell you that, it's really something different. So he convinced me to call my mother and call a hospital. And I hadn't talked to my mother in about 2 years at that time. And I went to a program. And I tell you what, you know, the program changed my life. You know, I would say my friend, with the help of a higher power, saved my life. You know, AA and that rehab really gave me a life worth living, you know. I got into the rehab, and I felt a little better. You know, the alcohol shakes had left me, and I was feeling good. And, you know, got a little cocky, you know, and thank you. And, you know, so I started being a real joker, because I'd done programs before, so I know how to say one day at a time, I'll admit and I'll accept. I know all the right things to say, but I never really believed half the stuff that came out of my mouth. So, you know, the counselor there kind of told me, you know, I've seen many girls like you. They come in here, you know, from these spoiled backgrounds, and, you know, they do their 28 days so they can leave the program and do the same thing over and over again. And you know what happens to girls like you? You die. I didn't like her. And but I tell you what, probably about 2 weeks into that, that woman told her story. And that woman's story was my story. And she had 17 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she talked about, you know, old dreams awakening and new dreams arising. She was a musician. You know, she got her life back. She got her family back. And, excuse me. A little dry. You know, and that was my first glimpse of real hope. And, you know, my mom really wasn't really believing it, you know, because I told her it was different this time. You know, I feel it, you know. I'm going to go out and make meetings. But she wasn't going to let me come home, so I had to go into a halfway house. I did 10 months in a halfway house. And there, when I got out of rehab, I did my 90 and 90. I actually probably did like 140 and 90. I got a sponsor, and I got commitments. You know, things started to get better slowly but surely. Like, I found myself showing up, like, and being, like, dependable, and then making me, like, floor rep at the halfway house. And you know, there was this girl in the house, and she was having a rough time. She had, like, eating disorder or something. Nobody really liked her. And I reached out to this girl, and I found out that she was a music therapy major at a nearby university. I talked to her, and I tell you what, in 2 weeks, I was accepted to that nearby university for music performance. And I didn't go talking to this girl in order to get accepted into college, but this is what happened just from reaching out to another alcoholic. And you know, when that happened, I didn't realize that I could ever really become something ever again. I thought I had ruined all my bridges, and I thought I had lost all my chances in the past. And I thought I was kind of too old to get my life back at 25. Like, I was too young for AA and too old to get my life back. And, you know, but, you know, things got better, and I started showing up in school, and, you know, people were telling me, oh, you're so great, you know, you play with your heart. And I'm like, well, these people only knew who I was, you know. And, you know, and I realized through this program that it's not where we were that counts, it's where we're going, you know. And, you know, I learned how to trust in a higher power. See, I came in here really like an atheist agnostic, you know, and the key to that problem for me was to read We Agnostics, and it really didn't help that problem for me. You know, it made me realize that I really needed to rely on a higher power unless I wanted to drink again, and I didn't want to drink again. So January 23rd of this year, the same gentleman that got me off the streets and told me that I was worth more, that I was better, that I could become something, died from this disease of alcoholism. And that day, I realized how real this disease was, that I really had to learn how to turn my will and my life over to the care of a higher power. It was really that serious for me. And that was the first time I think I really threw myself on the floor and cried and said, you know what, this pain is too much for me. This pain was too great. I couldn't take it. And it was the first time that I realized that I kind of had reservations. You know, it was the first time I wanted to drink. And I knew that I didn't want to, but I didn't know how to not, you know, just to get rid of this pain. You know, and the first time in my life, of all the deaths, usually when people die in my life, people take me out and get me drunk. You know, this time people took me to a meeting and told me to share about it. And I heard others' experiences about how they made it through death, how they made it through this. You people tell me that I can make it through anything without a drink. You know, thank you. And that if I take a drink, I'm totally out of the game. I don't have a shot. You know, and today I'm able to honor his name. You know, every time I pick up music, because he was a musician also. Every time I play my viola, every time I play the keys, I can honor him. And, you know, it's not always easy, but I tell you what, my life is a lot better. You know, I have a great sponsor who, when I got her, when I got a year, I thought she was really pretty and nice. So I thought my sponsorship situation was going to be pretty and nice. And it really wasn't, you know. And I thank her. I thank her for that. You know, she really, because when I came here, she brought me here to AG. When I came here to AG, I was kind of felt too unique. I felt like I was too young for AA, you know. And I came here and I saw all these beautiful young people loving life and accepting that they were alcoholics. And I needed to not feel unique anymore. And for that, I'm truly grateful. You know, I have my mother in my life and, you know, I call her every day. But I want to tell you what, I thank you all, I thank AA for saving my life, and that's all I had to share. Thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is John Kay.
My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's always an honor to speak at an AA meeting and to be amongst people who are committed to staying sober a day at a time, utilizing the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's also great to be here where so many people are counting days and beginning their journey into recovery. And speaking in front of such a large crowd like this, I have an almost irresistible urge to say something like, "Rise, my people." And that's because I'm an alcoholic. If I'm in the back of the room, I want to be in the front of the room. And if I'm in the front of the room, I want to be in the back of the room. And I'm never quite exactly where I want to be. But I'm glad to be here tonight, and I'm glad that this is a program that was started by two drunks talking to one another and telling one another their story. Not talking at one another, not talking to one another, but sharing their experience, strength, and hope. They say that God protects fools and drunks, and what he protects us from is our own emotional history. And when I was drinking, I drank to repress emotions that I found unacceptable, and I drank to feel anything at all. And I couldn't always tell which I was doing on any particular night. I was born and raised in the Midwest, and when I was about 20, I appeared on stage in a community theater production appropriately called The Drunkard. And I had about 14 words to say. They allowed me to be a policeman of some sort, and I said something like, "Let's get him out of here," several times. I don't remember my words. But I do remember the words of the leading character. And at one point, he was prone on the stage, propped up on an elbow, holding a bottle on top of him, and saying, "Is this to be the issue of my life?" And 40 years later, when I was 40 years old, 20 years later, I answered that question. It was indeed to be the issue of my life. And in recovery, alcoholism remains the issue of my life. Let me tell you what it was like, what happened, and a little bit about what it's like now. In the Midwest, my family owned a small meatpacking plant. That's what I called it. My father called it a slaughterhouse. My mother called it an abattoir. And that's sort of the way we communicated with one another. Alcohol was no stranger in my family, and ultimately my mother would die of this disease at the age of 60. But she was a long way from her bottom when I was living at home, and I left to go away to college, and thereafter I was only home on visit, so I didn't see the worst of it. But I did know about alcohol. My parents were products of the Depression and of wartime rationing, so we bought everything in bulk, and we bought beer in bulk. And I can remember even at a young age, we would, I should tell you that on my mother's side of the family, they were German Catholics, and they drank smart cocktails, martinis, standing up in the living room, and when they got drunk, they fell down. And on my father's side of the family, they were Dutch Christian Reformed, a Calvinist sect that was rather strict and prohibited the consumption of alcohol. So they drank in the basement, sitting down on sofas, and they drank beer and consumed enormous quantities of carbohydrates. So I knew all about alcohol, and I knew that we couldn't buy alcohol in our part of town because we lived in the Dutch part of town. So we drove one of the pickup trucks to the other side of town and bought beer in bulk, 16 cases, 20 cases, 24 cases. And it had to be covered up with a tarpaulin, and when we got back, we had to drive in the garage with it, take the tarpaulin off, and carry the cases downstairs. And even at 10, 11, 12, I participated in that. And I knew there was something very special about alcohol. And I knew at some level that it probably was not a good thing for me to start this, because I knew that it was going to be trouble for me. It was just too attractive. And everything that was attractive to me, I overdid. They say that alcoholics as well are more likely than non-alcoholics to remember their first drink. I don't know whether that's true or not, but my first drink was in 1959. It was the last Saturday in October. It was at 9 p.m., right after the Perry Mason show, and I loved it. For the first time in my life, I felt as though I was together. The inside and the outside seemed to match. I had been promised by my parents that if I didn't drink or smoke until I was 21, they would buy me a car. I don't know about the wisdom of that, but all I know is that I started when I was 18, and I knew when I put that first drink to my lips that it was going to cost me half a car. And I did not care. When I consumed alcohol, when alcohol took over my life, it cost me a lot more than the cost of any single drink. And yet I knew it, and I did it anyway. I also knew before I took that first drink that there might be the problems that I referred to, and so I was sort of the caretaker. Other kids in school that I went to in high school began to experiment with beer at an early stage, and I didn't do that. I was the one who drove the car. I was the goody two-shoes. I was the one, in fact, who was heard to say, if you had a complete personality, you wouldn't need to drink that stuff. I wasn't always very popular either, and I couldn't figure that out. But when I started in earnest. And it wasn't long before I was a regular drinker. I certainly was not a daily drinker at the very beginning. I was ambitious, and that covered up a multitude of character defects. But I do know this, that when I started drinking, I rapidly arrived at a point where I never considered a gathering a party unless alcohol was being served. Before I picked up my first drink, I did lots of things that were a party. Growing up as a kid, there were birthday parties. There were all kinds of parties in high school. And I went to parties, and I labeled them parties, and I attended them as parties. It wasn't too long after I picked up my first drink, but that I didn't consider a gathering a party unless alcohol was being served. I also remember that growing up, I participated in lots of things. I went to school activities, I participated in sports, and I had fun. And I considered those things to be fun. Fun was the label I put on a lot of the activities that I participated in. But once I'd had my first drink and became accustomed to it, I never considered anything to be really a fun time unless I was drinking at it. I also remember that first drink because the gang was over at my house and my parents were not. And I called them to tell them that I was going to have a drink that night. It seemed appropriate. In the house that I grew up in, the beer, as I mentioned, was kept down in the basement. And the cold beer was always at the ready in the refrigerator, and the empties went under the sink. There was sort of this triangle that even as a child I participated in. And while my classmates were learning about trade routes and other things in geography, I was following the beer. And I remember that that smell of stale beer. And I remember thinking there was something very mysterious and adult about it. And I also remember that as my parents' economic circumstances improved, they graduated from beer. And they went to whiskey, something called Seven and Sevens. And I followed that with interest. And a little bit later on, my mother would begin to drink martinis. And later on, I would develop a taste for martinis. And you really have to develop a taste for martinis. I mean, martinis taste like something you'd sit in to remove a tattoo. And I knew that they kept the hard liquor. That was kept in the living room. And that was kept in the bottom of the china closet. And that was lined, the bottom was, with felt. It had a door on it that when you closed it, it went click. And I knew there was something special about the stuff that was in there. And I knew there was something almost holy about it. Because I went to a church where they had a tabernacle. And when the tabernacle closed, it went click. And somehow those things became associated in my mind. So I started out drinking that first night that I drank. And they had told me that I could have a drink. And because of the driving in the Midwest, I was told that my friends couldn't leave the house. We had a number of bedrooms upstairs, and everybody had to sort of swear an oath that they would stay there all night. And even then, I got the biggest glass I could find, which could have held some gladiolas had it needed to. And I sort of let it be known with a wink and a nod that it wouldn't bother me if that first and only drink was never empty. I would later meet a sponsor in this program who defined alcoholic manipulation as getting what you want without really asking for it. And I knew what he was talking about because I had been doing that from my first drink. And what happened to me on that first drink was the magic that I mentioned to you. I fell down, I got drunk, I spit up all over my shoes. When my parents came home, I told them I loved them, and I didn't know whether that was true or not. I learned that under the influence of alcohol, I could do things and say things and be a part of the crowd in a way that I had never felt before. I went back to college. I didn't drink again for about 3 weeks. And then I started to drink. I should tell you that I ultimately went into a profession that has a great deal of respect, or is supposed to, for rules and regulations, for laws and prohibitions. I'm the sort of person that's sort of a belt and suspenders type. I didn't break the laws. I didn't double park. But when it came to alcohol, I made up the rules as I went along, because the good Lord and I knew that there had to be some special laws that applied to alcohol and favored only me. And those were the things that I did. I ignored everything that I'd learned when it came to alcohol. I drank underage. Ultimately, I would drink aboard ship in the Navy, which was a serious offense at the time. It did not bother me one bit. The only thing that might have bothered me was if I had gotten caught. There came a time in my life when I began to realize, sort of at the edges of my consciousness, not that I was an alcoholic, or not that I had a problem with alcohol or anything of the sort, but that alcohol had become important to me. The age, the drinking age where I was brought up was 21. And just to give an indication that helps remind me of the kind of alcoholic I am, the state issued something called a liquor card. And it was almost as important as what a draft card would later be. And if you had a liquor card, they had to serve you, at least in my mind. You no longer had to sneak around, no longer had to pretend to be somebody you weren't. And on the morning of my 21st birthday, at 8 a.m., I was sitting on the courthouse steps. and I was there to get my liquor card. The rite of passage that would entitle me to drink the way I'd been drinking for 3 or more years. I began to drink more and more frequently, and I began to notice that when I was younger, I was filled with a sense of awe and wonder at life, a sense of curiosity, a real desire to learn things and a kind of joy at learning things. To me, there was something spiritual about that. But as I grew up and as alcohol began to take over my life, I began to lose that sense of awe and wonder. I began to notice that it was more and more difficult to stay focused and to concentrate. I began to notice that my pursuit of something I called being sophisticated was really a pursuit of something that would take me to a place of being cynical and jaundiced. And I didn't regard that as a loss of a spiritual life or loss of spirit. I just regarded that as part of the price that I paid for being somebody who loved to drink. I finished college and I went in the Navy. I loved the Navy. The Navy had structure to it. The Navy had rules and regulations. The Navy had a daily plan. I knew who to salute and who to salute me, who was supposed to salute me. But I didn't perceive that as any reason to stop drinking. So I didn't. I also know that we made a number of trips abroad. I spent a lot of time. I joined the Navy to see the world. And the people that I was on board ship with would go ashore at these foreign ports, and they would see the world. They would go to museums and art galleries and cathedrals and those sorts of things. I didn't. I went usually to some place called something like Le Chat Noir, the Black Cat, or some similar bar with some similar name that was right down by the harbor. And I would listen to these people come back with the tales of where they'd been and what they'd done and what they'd seen, and I had no interest in it whatsoever. I have pictures of coastline that I don't even know what country it is, because I would drag out of the port and aboard my ship and not even remember where I'd been. I also remember that during that period of time, alcohol began to get me into trouble. I once heard that in some respects, alcoholism is a hearing disorder. I puzzled about that until I realized that once I got sober, there were a lot of people who told me that they told me that they noticed I drank a lot. They told me that I gulped alcohol instead of swallowed it. They, in fact, told me that I was using it as a medicine rather than as a beverage. They had told me that they hoped I would get help. In fact, my whole body was telling me that I was doing something to it that I ought not to be doing. And I did not care. I did not hear those people. I did not hear my own body tell me that what I was doing to it was not healthy. I left the Navy. I returned to school in the Midwest and got an additional degree. And now it was becoming even more difficult to focus, to concentrate, to study. And alcohol was becoming a regular part of my life. And I was vaguely aware that it seemed to be getting in my way. I can remember driving once on a multi-lane highway and detoxing. I would not have known what was happening then, but I knew that I was sort of in a different dimension than what the car was in. That my mind would tell me that I had to turn left, that I had to turn right, and I would have to consciously send some sort of signal to my hands to do that. And ultimately, I had to pull over to the side of the road because something was happening to me that I did not understand. But I wasn't about to quit drinking. In fact, I didn't even associate it with drinking. What I did was I came to New York, and I thought really that it was important that I be in New York. I really thought, to me, New York was a dot on the map. And I thought that here's where all the people are, the movies and the shakers. Here are the people who send the word out that, say, in the field of art or history or politics or whatever, this is how you should do or think. And I thought if I could just get there, maybe things would be all right. Well, I got here, and it came as sort of a surprise that you had to get an apartment, you had to buy groceries, you had to do the laundry. And I wasn't really equipped or prepared for that. So I found out where the nearest liquor stores, in the plural, were, so that I could spread my business around. And I got a job. I got a job and made friends with a partner at that firm and his wife, who drank a bit like I did, or rather I drank like they did. And I made a good martini, and they appreciated that. And that advanced my career rather rapidly. And so I approved of that. It wasn't long, though, before alcohol was really getting in my way. And I did again what I thought New Yorkers did. I went to see a psychiatrist. And actually, his office was right across the street here. And I walked up and down before I'd done this, because it seemed to me this was something on the order of a commitment. And I told him that my career had progressed rather well, but I wasn't happy, and I was hoping he could make me happy. And he allowed as to how he might be able to do that, but it would take more than one visit, and that I should come back. And in fairness to him, he also told me that maybe I should read Marty Mann's book on alcoholism. And I did that, and we talked about my alcoholism, or potential alcoholism, the psychiatrist and I, and we finally decided that Alcoholics Anonymous was a place where people had pretty rough stories, and that I probably wouldn't identify with them. But he did diagnose a Librium deficiency, and he thought he could cure that. So for the next 7 years, we had what I would later call a literary relationship. I would write checks, and he would write prescriptions. And I maxed out at about 3 times a week. And after 7 years, guess what? My story was rough enough to join you folks here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember October of 1981. It was the month of doctor's appointments, and the psychiatrist had sent me to all these internists. And they kept looking for something organically wrong. And I desperately wanted them to find something organically wrong, something they could cut out, something they could radiate, something they could treat. But they kept saying, there's nothing organically wrong. And one of them, his sole interest seemed to be in tapping my abdomen. And I couldn't figure that out. That didn't seem to me like something you needed to go to medical school to do. But finally, I was told, yes, indeed, I was an alcoholic, and it would be best if I got help. In fact, my condition was so serious that if I didn't get help, there was a strong likelihood that I would be dead within 90 days. And so I was sent off to the middle of Pennsylvania, and I spent 12 days there in a detox. And I spent 30 days there in a rehab, because they'd found out that in the process of consuming massive amounts of alcohol, a depressant, I'd become clinically depressed. And they did not feel that they could allow me to come back to New York City before they could immediately set up an appointment with a psychiatrist who was familiar with alcoholism, with the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and knew something about how to treat clinical depression. But I also remember saying to one of the therapists at the rehab, I said to him, you know, I've come here, and I came here with a lot of labels. I was somebody's son. I was somebody else's partner. I was a member of a particular religion. I had a certain profession. And you've stripped every single one of those labels off of me. And the only one you've left me with is alcoholic. And I remember he thought for a moment, and he looked at me and he said, John, if you can remember that, you might be one of the lucky ones. And I am grateful that in the years since then, by attending meetings, by keeping company with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, by working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't given myself a chance to forget that, because on my own, I most assuredly would. In any event, I came back to New York, and I was treated at St. Vincent's Hospital down in the village. And though I had admitted myself when the door closed, as it used to say in one of the stories in the back of the big book, the only lock was on the other side. And there I was. I'd gone from the 26th floor of a corner office overlooking the canyons of Lower Broadway to a locked ward where they had taken my tie, and they had taken my shoelaces, and they had taken my belt, and they took my cigarette lighter because I could not be trusted with any of those things. And that is what alcohol did to me. And it is well that I should remember it. And I remember that the first night that I was there, I dined alone in the dining room. And they don't allow you to have real sharp things in a place such as that. So the silverware, such as, well, that's a misnomer, the utensils were plastic. And the plate was a paper plate, and the cup was styrofoam. And I noticed all this, and I noticed that on departing the dining area, they had three barrels. And one of them was labeled plastic, and another was labeled paper, and another was labeled styrofoam. And in my alcoholic arrogance, even in that condition, I could see they had a system here. There was order in this place, and I approved, and I understood it. Except that when I got up there, I did not know what to do, because that's what alcohol had done to me. Intellectually, I could understand things. Intellectually, my mind was racing a mile a minute. In fact, it was racing so fast that it would not slow down long enough for me to make a decision. And after I'd held up the line as long as was deemed appropriate, a very kind nurse walked over, gently took my hand, and helped me empty my tray, one thing at a time, into the appropriate barrel. And that, too, is where alcohol took me, and it's well that I should remember that. I began to attend meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous on a pass from the hospital. I was there for nearly 7 weeks. I spent Christmas and New Year's of 1981, 1982 there. And I was told that I should find a home group. I was told that I should find a sponsor. I was told that I should try to share. And I could not do any of those things. Those two seemed to be decisions of enormous magnitude. But I was also told that I should look at a lot of meetings and I should find a place that was warm for me. And I shouldn't necessarily look for a sponsor. I should listen for a sponsor. And I did all those things, and Bob R., who may be known to some of you, the late beloved Bob R., became my sponsor for 21 years. And at the end of that period, I figured, you know, it takes a long time to train a sponsor, and you just don't want to throw them away for any given reason. And Bob was so very dear to me. And I realized that, again, the wonderful wisdom of this program, that it wasn't about talking at people, it wasn't about telling people what to do, it was about living it. I'm never good at languages, and I was once told the reason that I'm not is because in my mind I hear things in English and then I translate them to someplace up there and then into a foreign language and I go back that way. And there was something about this program that I was starting to do the same way. I was intellectualizing it. And Bob helped me to understand that this program is about living the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's about being of service to others. I waited a while after Bob died in 2004 before getting another sponsor, but I now have another sponsor because I realize that's an important part of my recovery. And I was told, get a sponsor who has a sponsor. And that was an important bit of information as well. And it's been my privilege to be of service at various levels in Alcoholics Anonymous. And a friend of mine out in Colorado says, what a wonderful joy it is, number one, to see people get sober, to see a newcomer come in, and to see the light come on behind their eyes, and to participate with them in that journey. And another great joy in recovery is, as my friend in Colorado says, to walk among the tall trees, to be amongst those who place a value on their recovery and who understand the importance of sharing that recovery and passing on what was so freely given to all of us here to the next person, and to expect nothing whatever in return except the right to continue to stay sober one day at a time. I thank you all for the service that you render to one another, for the service that brings to life this wonderful program and this wonderful fellowship, and I thank you all for your sobriety. Thank you.